This week, on a special episode of WebMD's Health Discovered podcast, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
When I first heard the words, "you have lung cancer," I was in shock.
It's a diagnosis that changes everything. So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The morning after a rather impactful hearing, and I guess I should confess, I have, two things that I appear to be wrong about, and I'm only going to spend a short amount of time on this, and I'm certainly not limiting it to two things. But number one, it looks like the NRA is about to lose bigly on gun control legislation. I think listeners of this podcast know that I have been hopeful, but deeply skeptical and cynical about the ability of Washington to get any kind of legislation through. It's not perfect. It does not solve the problem, but it is a remedy. And for the first time in 30 years, they were able to put together a bipartisan majority. So remarkable. NRA is all in against it. I suppose one could be really cynical and think that we're engaging in this massive kabuki dance where everyone is doing what is in their interest. The NRA knows it's that it has to be opposed, although it knows that the legislation could have been a lot worse. But okay, but it is positive, so I have to set aside my cynicism once again. Number two, I really did underestimate how significant yesterday's hearing was going to be. I really thought it was going to be kind of a parenthesis, that we would hear things that we'd heard before. In fact, I think that yesterday's hearing packed up more of an emotional wallop than the predecessors. And for those of you that are subscribers, my newsletter this morning is just jam-packed with insights from our all-star team. I'm Tim Miller, Mona Charon, Sarah Longwell, Will Salatin, Bill Kristol, Amanda Carpenter. So I would refer you to that. But you know, the top lines on all of this, we were reminded of the importance of honor and decency, and that sometimes just doing your job is heroic, just showing up and doing your job in the face of all of these threats. And, number two, there are just smoking guns all around. And I was struck by this over and over again, that even setting the insurrection aside for the moment, there are tapes, actual effing tapes of Trump's role in a massive conspiracy to overthrow the election. And sometimes we get numbed about all of this because we've been living through it. And sometimes we've been numbed by the hair on fire rhetoric. But as I said last week, imagine if we were learning all of this now in real time. Also, as Brad Raffensperger's testimony reminded us, Trump's falsehoods about this election weren't just lies. They were easily and repeatedly refuted lies. They are absurd falsehoods that were, again, debunked quickly and again and again and again without much ambiguity. And yet the MAGA world folks continue to spew this stuff and people continue to believe it. And I guess my bottom line is, Trump did this, all of it, the pressure, the bullying, the threats. And we really got a glimpse yesterday of the human toll. And in the newsletter today, Sarah Longwell, Tim Miller, and Mona Charon write very eloquently about all of this, what this deeply malevolent man did when he brought the full weight of the American presidency to bear on low-level officials, trying to pressure them to violate their oaths and to smear innocent private citizens who are just trying to do their duty. And again, there was so much news that came out of this. Trump was directly involved in the fraudulent elector plot. And of course, my fellow cheesehead Ron Johnson, long sigh here, was really busted. Amanda Carpenter has a great piece on this, but the fact that Ron Johnson's aide, apparently at one point on January 6th, suggested that he was going to deliver fake fraudulent electors to Vice President Pence, and Pence said, "just don't do it." And Johnson's just all over the place. I mean, kind of like, "I have no idea what I was doing. I did not know this." And I think the technical term is weak-ass non-denial denial followed by a quasi-confession. And in any case, but before we get into it, and our guest today, and by the way, welcome back, Greg Lukianoff, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. The organization formerly known as the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, hey, so you kind of rebranded, but you kept the fire, right?
Yeah. We wanted to keep the name and the logo. We're all First Amendment free speech nerds at FIRE. And so we were originally thinking that if we were going to expand beyond just our focus on campus that we've had since 99, that we might rebrand as the Free Speech League, which for First Amendment nerds is actually the group that preceded the ACLU, like the group that not a lot of people have heard of. But every time we got through this conversation, we're like, you know what? FIRE is just a better, more interesting, more memorable name. So let's just figure out a way to keep it. And just changing the E to end expression was a solution that was staring us right in the face.
Okay, well, I want to get into this more in depth, but you know, the fact that you are expanding your focus from the campus seems to be desperately needed since the attacks on free speech have spilled over from the campus to the rest of society. I mean, I think what you're doing is you're tracking the assault on free expression that seems to be, I mean, everywhere. And I want to get back to this, but can I just play for you a couple of sound bites from, well, actually one sound bite from yesterday. I mean, there were just so many. We could devote the entire podcast to doing this, to playing, you know, Shay Moss, who talks about how her life was destroyed, or her mother, who was singled out by the president of the United States and says she doesn't feel safe. But I want to play, you know, one of the things that surprised me was, you know, Rusty Bowers, who is the Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives. And he was, I'll be honest about it, he wasn't really on my radar screen. And, he was one of the unexpected stars of the hearing. And he talks about duty and faith. And just play one little soundbite from Rusty Bowers from yesterday.
First of all, when the people, and in Arizona, I believe it was some 40 plus years earlier, the legislature had established the manner of electing our officials or the electors for the presidential race. Once it was given to the people, as in Bush v. Gore, illustrated by the Supreme Court, it becomes a fundamental right of the people. So as far as I was concerned, for someone to ask me in the, I would call it a paucity. There was no evidence being presented of any strength. Evidence can be hearsay evidence. It's still evidence, but it's still hearsay. But strong judicial quality evidence, anything that would say to me, you have a doubt, deny your oath. I will not do that. And on more than one occasion throughout all this, that has been brought up. And it is a tenet of my faith that the Constitution is divinely inspired of my most basic foundational beliefs. And so for me to do that because somebody just asked me to is foreign to my very being. I will not do it.
So what struck me about that, Greg, was, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, democracy is at risk or the attack on norms or, you know, nerdy allegiances to constitutional principles. But there are these moments when you step back and you go, oh, my God, you know, thank goodness. We should be so grateful for public servants with honor and decency. And as I mentioned before, you know, here's a guy who is deeply conservative, deeply religious, and explaining why he just wasn't going to go along with the lie. And, you know, unfortunately, he's very much an outlier now in the Republican Party. But, you know, these are, you know, when we talk about principles in the abstract, this is where it becomes tangible. This is where it actually matters.
Yeah. Rusty reminds me of our mutual friend, David French.
Yeah.
You know, just a deeply principled person. And it's kind of funny because, like, up until pretty recently, in the small L sense, it seemed like everybody was a liberal, like in the sense we believe in, you know, democratic norms. Like, so we agreed on an awful lot. And that's changed both on the left and the right in the past 10 years. And it's kind of unusual. I was talking to someone last night and realizing that as much as Twitter may hate, you know, centrists, I think this is one of the first times in American history that, you know, free speech at the moment is more of a center value than it is on either fringes, which is really historically unusual. But I always say this, I'm a long-term optimist about the future of free speech because free speech works really well, and it's absolutely necessary for a democratic society. It lets you know where your problems are. I am very nervous about, let's say the next 5 years. I don't know. I think things could go wronger than they already have.
Well, your last book was The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And I understand that you're working on a new book about cancel culture, which, again, deep breath, is a real thing. Right. And you know, I'm glad what you articulated is something that's really been bothering me because, you know, I remember there was a time when small L liberals supported free speech. And then there was this period in which, particularly when there was political correctness on campus, when conservatives embraced the idea of academic freedom. And now all of that seems eroded.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's this pincer attack.
Yep.
From the authoritarian right and from the purist left on free speech. So it does feel right now as if free speech is more vulnerable than it's been, more vulnerable than any time that I can remember in my professional life.
Yeah. No. It's I would say 2020 was the worst year I'd seen.
But really?
From 2020 until now, there are more professors fired over a short period of time than I've seen in my entire career.
How many? What are we talking about here?
Our latest data is just right around 700 attempts to get professors fired since 2015. And we started counting in 2015, by the way, because prior to 2014, I had never seen, my career starts in 2001, within my own career, a tenured professor get fired for something that was clearly related to research or expression. I mean, Ward Churchill got fired, but they based that on fairly real and extensive academic misconduct.
That's a flashback, yeah.
Yeah. So 2014, and that first case, by the way, was a professor at Kansas State University who, after the Newtown shooting, said, "May it be your kids next time, NRA." And they went after him. And it's just seems to have gotten worse most years. I think it actually stayed about the same, the number of professors targeted. We just did a big jump up, about 100 or maybe 90 new examples. We were around, you know, 6, 10 only a couple weeks ago, but partially because Turning Point USA has gone from simply naming professors that they think are too lefty, but then giving, you know, contact information about how to get them, you know, how to get them in trouble. I'm like, that's a cancellation attempt, you know, like that. That's attempting to get rid of somebody. So that 700 include both attacks from the right and the left. And the maddening thing about this is that, you know, I'm also a constitutional history, free speech nerd going all the way back to the founding. This is historic. You know, hundreds of professors fired over a brief period of time. From my reading for the second Red Scare, you know, the estimates are, you know, maybe 100 to 150 professors fired during the second Red Scare. So this is historic, and you still have people trying to gaslight you saying this isn't happening at all. We're going to be studying what happened in America in a variety of ways, but also relating to freedom of speech in 50 years. But the idea that you still have people saying this isn't a real thing, even though it pops up in all the polling, even though there's different ways you can prove things. You can cite authority. Authority's been saying this is a problem for a long time, and those numbers have grown. You know, you ask professors, you ask average American citizens, do they feel like they could get fired for their point of view? It's been higher than, you know, I've ever seen in the polling. So, you know, I'm working on this book called Canceling the American Mind, which is as a follow-up to Coddling. I joke that I'm stuck with gerunding of the American mind, so I might as well just, you know, I might as well just stick with it. And one of the reasons why we're calling it cancel culture, which is not a term I've ever particularly loved, but when we looked at the data about America, about what Americans think of cancel culture, white, black, left, right, they know the term cancel culture. They're afraid of losing their jobs.
Define cancel culture for me before we move on. Just can you define it? Because we're going to get a lot of blowback saying, you know, anytime you use words like woke or cancel, what do you mean by cancel culture?
Yeah, my definition of cancel culture that I talked about at the Daily Beast in a long piece I did with Comey Frey, who's our top researcher for attempts to get professors fired, was pretty simple but also a historical one. Sometime around a major uptick around 2014 of successful attempts to get people fired for what would have otherwise been constitutionally protected speech. Now, I explained that very simply, and I had some people saying, you know, well, the following things would be, you know, unprotected, and you could be fired for that. And my answer is, okay, if you want the really technical one, the answer is, but by constitutionally protected speech, I'm saying under the 1960s Pickering decision, yeah. that said you're allowed to have free speech rights as a citizen. So that's been my definition, and I try to make it historic because I do think this is closely tied to the ability of people, because people have always tried to get people fired for their point of view. They just couldn't get a ferocious, you know, social media mob together before there was social media.
Right. So, you know, you say that you are concerned short term, but you are optimistic long term. And I certainly do not want to, I don't want to kill the optimistic buzz, but I want to talk about that.
Sure. And to be clear, I'm half Russian. So like even my optimism is fairly pessimistic.
All right. We have Greg Lukianoff, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, which used to be, you know, focused on education. But given the fact that we're not just talking about firing professors anymore, are we? I mean, this seems to be part of our culture where, and there's so many different aspects I want to talk about with you about all of this, including why this is happening now. And what I'm noticing is, and you've written about this in The Coddling of the American Mind, there is this belief among a lot of people that individuals should be protected from speech that offends them or hurts them, the conflation of speech with violence, that if people are hurt by ideas or words that, well, we ought to take action about this, that yes, speech should be free, and you've heard this over and over again, speech should be free, except speech that makes people feel unsafe or that makes people, fearful, or whatever. So, or speech that is hate speech. So give me some sense about why this is happening, why there is this, where did these ideas come from that a university, which used to be a place where, you know, ideas were vigorously exchanged, should be a safe space, or that ideas posed a threat?
Yeah, so if you look back at the history of higher education, you know, its ups and downs. Prior to 1940, there wasn't even a serious conception of academic freedom that was accepted. The AUP talked a good game on it in 1915, the American Association of University Professors, but the tenure protections didn't get passed until much later. Then, of course, you have, you know, going up to the McCarthy period, and there was starting to, both in American society and in American law, you started having an improvement in the state of First Amendment law in the late 50s, after the McCarthy fever had passed, and an improvement in an idea of free speech culture. And that culminated on campus with the beginning of the campus free speech movement in 64. And by 1974, you actually had some really strongly favorable free speech opinions in the Supreme Court favoring even student speech, which was, you know, an impressive change. Already by 1980, though, you start having people like Richard Delgado, proposing that actually the more enlightened society would restrict speech that could be found to be sexist or racist. So this was the 80s is when purest idea of freedom of speech, you know, that maybe existed for all of a decade on campus.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
Started to flip. In the 80s, however, the people who were opposing the speech code movement off campus included liberals, included conservatives, included most of the media, included comedians. But over time, this idea of, you know, we can limit speech if we practice enlightened censorship never went away. And the people who really believed in it the most were the administrators themselves. But here's one of the problems. And my co-author, Jonathan Haidt, has a whole organization called Heterodox Academy that's trying to improve viewpoint diversity on campus, because you get really unfortunate results if you don't actually know anybody who doesn't think like you. So I think after decades of particularly the administrations of schools leaning more consistently to the left and the professoriate, it's gotten worse, you know, within the past even couple of years, but also within the past few decades, that once you're actually go from being a minority opinion to being the majority, that's pretty normal for people to start becoming more free speech skeptical, because it interferes with what they can say or do. So in some ways, it's partially the curse of becoming hegemonic, developing power. But when it comes to why right now, once again, and it's an answer that Height and I come back to a lot, but we think that the major change was social media. We think that 2014, you know, exploded in particular because we saw a lot of people who grew up with this, frankly, kind of absolutely awful social media environment for saying anything controversial, and sort of brought those attitudes and those practices with them to higher education. And suddenly, you know, letters that could have just been thrown out or ignored, when they result in a, you know, a social media mob demanding you fire that professor or that vice president of marketing or that journalist, suddenly those people could actually whip up a crowd like never before. So I think what I liken the situation we're to right now is it's as if we're looking at the printing press from the point of view of the year 1521.
Hmm.
And this is when Henry VIII started clamping down on the printing press, because from the point of view of 1521, it led to a great deal of social upheaval. It led to religious wars. It led to blasphemy. It led to an increase in the witch trials. You know, from that point of view, the printing press wasn't worth it. I feel like we're in a stage where suddenly we've added billions of people to the conversation, able to talk directly to them. That's going to have to be highly disruptive. But for the long-term optimism, when you suddenly introduce this many people into a conversation, eventually my hope is that we can make something much more productive as opposed to something as destructive as what social media has wrought in recent years.
Okay, so in your description, though, and you're focusing on colleges and academic
yes.
freedom, you're talking about we didn't really have a concept until 1940. So this is one of my takeaways from this, is that you pull the lens back a moment, and you realize that respect for free speech, you know, was about 5 minutes old and lasted
yes.
for about 5 minutes. And yep. that perhaps in the great, you know, the norm of all of civilization, including much of the history of this country, has
yep.
really not embraced an expansive view of free speech. That really, free speech is very much a not just delicate, but a little abnormal in terms of
yeah.
history.
Well, I call my blog The Eternally Radical Idea because,
yeah.
you know, and it's a reference to free speech, because my
yeah.
theory is that, you know, you know it's a radical idea because in every generation, brave people stand up to oppose freedom of speech. And usually freedom of speech is on the losing side. Now, I will say the rise of democracies necessitated, you know, some amount, or democratic republics necessitated some amount of freedom of speech. So you had, you know, folk traditions protecting freedom of speech that, you know, in the early 19th century, the First Amendment didn't mean almost anything at all. But there was a great book called The People's Darling Privilege by Michael Kent Curtis that talks about the thing that kept the South from passing anti-abolitionist speech laws in the North was not that they thought they couldn't do it. It was because of a popular understanding that would be restricting the rights of people in the North. But yeah, free speech is mostly on the losing side of this. And I think that for people, you know, around our age, we could kind of take for granted the idea that free speech culture, that we had norms that basically meant, you know, people are entitled to their opinion, being the simplest idiom that expresses it. But also the law, you know, had been improving pretty much since a really bad decision called Dennis in the early 1950s. Pretty much from that point on, free speech law has been improving. But it is fragile. It is something that's always going to be controversial. There's no way to do it that's not going to mean that some people are offended or hurt, you know, quite a bit. And as we get away from some of the norms of, you know, what people call a culture of dignity, the idea that sort of like everyone's an equal democratic citizen, but that means you also, you know, you promote norms like sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. As we get further away from that, it was completely predictable and predicted that you'd start seeing, you know, a disenchantment with freedom of speech. But as we're seeing what it looks like for people's career trajectories, I hope that we're reaching a stage where enough Americans are like, do I really have to like just completely shut up about my opinions about everything from now on if I want to keep my job? I don't think that's one of the reasons why a big part of our expansion is doing a massive sort of like public service announcement campaign on free speech norms.
So let's make this a little bit more difficult.
Sure.
Because okay, you and I understand what the First Amendment means, But it's important to point out, and, yep. and this is where a lot of the, and I, obviously your expansion, you're recognizing this, the First Amendment does not apply to the private sector. So, for right. example, companies, employers have the right, or let me ask you, do they have the right to fire employees for the engaging in free speech or speech that might be controversial or offensive?
They do, in terms of, you know, their rights as corporations. Our point with the free speech culture idea, and I did this debate with Ken White in Reason Magazine, where I think I got a layout mm-hmm. what my argument was, the best mm-hmm. that I've laid it out, is that eventually, if every, because, you know, you have the freedom of association to form a company that is both a widget factory and has a strong political identity. But when you start thinking in terms of, what if every company is like that? What if every company has decided that they're, you know, they're either this is a lefty company or a righty company, and anybody who publicly disagrees with us is going to get fired? That's something that those corporations can do, but that's not good. That's not healthy for a democracy. So one of the reasons why we talk about free speech culture, you know, and I think people right. should be, you know, corporations should be welcoming this, because there's a lot of movement, particularly on the right, to do top down solutions to this, you know, to take over social media and try to quote unquote fix it. What we're saying is,
or to punish companies for, retaliate against companies for engaging in free speech.
Exactly. Yeah. So what we're trying to do is put a thumb sort of back on the scale for the idea of, like, all things being equal, I think it's probably better if fewer people get fired for stating their honest, authentic political opinions.
Well, I mean, what you're describing, though, is moving from concepts, you know, the legal definition of free speech
yes.
under the First Amendment and academic freedom to a culture of free speech, which requires people to tolerate speech they may not like, and then to restrain themselves
yep.
from enforcing those views on others. Now, that strikes me as even more difficult in some ways.
Absolutely.
Because with the First Amendment, you at least can go to court and say, well, yeah. this is what the law is, or academic freedom, you can point out, you know, contractual obligations. But the culture is basically to say, okay, you know, you don't have a right not to be offended. Or diversity obviously also means, or ought to mean, diversity of ideas, which is, I have to tell you, a vanishingly rare understanding in some circles, where people really have internalized the idea that if they read or hear something they don't like, that they should do something about it to yeah. stop it or shut it down. And well, and that, you know, that, and that strikes me as a taller mountain to climb.
Absolutely. And that's why, so we're doing this $75 million expansion over 3 years. You know, we're like an $18, $19 million organization just focused on campus. But we've, you know, I'm not a religious person myself, but I do talk about how the organization, we all felt kind of called to the idea of expanding beyond campus, and unapologetically explaining, like, listen, there's free speech law, but free speech law can't do it all by itself. You have to have these norms, or the law is just not going to mean all that much. And that was the source of my debate with Ken, was essentially, I think free speech culture is ultimately, particularly over the long run, more important than free speech law, because free speech culture is what creates the law. And if free speech culture completely erodes, that all the norms, you know, think that people should be punished for ever offending anybody, the law is eventually going to suffer as well. And so I give historical parallels, you know, like, what is free speech law without free speech culture? It's the old Soviet Union, which had promises of freedom of speech. It's North Korea. I think maybe Iran, like, has promises of freedom of speech. Yeah, it's really? One of these things where right. it's just laughable. Like, it doesn't mean anything. But free speech culture without free speech law, a good example of that is Enlightenment France. Because Voltaire, Rousseau, Condorcet, all of these great thinkers, they got in trouble for, some of them went to jail, some of them were threatened with going to jail for their writings and for their opinions. But at the same time, Enlightenment France, because even though the law wasn't on their side, there was a cultural norm of hearing people out, of engaging in philosophy, of having discussions. And I think the world is better for those thinkers having a free speech culture, even if the law took a long time to catch up.
Okay, so in the spirit of making this conversation more difficult, I want to just change a focus and ask you a series of questions. Okay, we're talking about free speech in the abstract. I'm thinking of things that can get you canceled.
Yeah.
And for people who hate the phrase both sides, I am sorry. This is coming from both sides, and yeah. we can illustrate this. So there is, and again, we're moving off of university campuses because that's part of your focus, but
yeah.
So someone writes a book or gives a speech or puts out a tweet saying the evidence is overwhelming that that African Americans are genetically mentally inferior to white people. Is that free speech, or would and should either academic freedom and or the culture of free speech tolerate that? See, I told you it was going to make it more difficult.
Sure, yeah. And when it comes to those kind of issues, you know, that's some of the most radioactive stuff. And I will say that, you know, working at FIRE for 21 years now, it's amazing how much more popular the speech that can get you in trouble on campus would be than the scenario you just gave. So is that kind of speech protected? Yes. Charles Murray, you know, wrote a book making this argument for Encounter Books. He wasn't arrested, nor should he be. If he was a professor and he got fired for it, he'd have a very strong free speech First Amendment claim. Now, the thing about culture, though, is that it's not, and this is one of the things that drives Ken crazy, is one, you know, people are hypocrites. And I'm somewhat more sort of like resigned to the fact that people are free speech hypocrites in a lot of cases. So sometimes people who argue free speech culture are arguing it only, you know, tactically when it's someone they like getting in trouble, when someone they don't like. When it comes to free speech culture, it can't be the same kind of cut and dry norms. You know, cut and dry norms are law, but a thumb on the scale for it's better to know what people really think is essentially what we're trying to bring to the discussion.
All right.
Does that mean that people can't be fired for embarrassing their companies? Of course not. However, that being said, if you don't actually embrace some amount of voluntary free speech culture, my fear is that whether it's right or left, you're going to start having some of these norms imposed in a really clumsy way from above.
So I have written down some of these questions, and I will tell you, Greg, you know, even though that you and I are, you know, in a pretty safe space for having this kind of conversation, I actually am hesitant to read some of these questions. because I know even in the Bulwark world, there will be people who will cancel their subscriptions because I say, I'm asking this question, is saying, is this free speech? So, I mean, this is, again, kind of illustrating the problem we have here. So the first one I asked was the, and I'm sorry to say, Charles Murray question about that. What about someone who says you cannot be a woman if you have a penis? Here it comes.
Yeah. And that has been one of the things that in the last 5 years has been one of the most radioactive topics is anything related to transgender. And honestly, I've never seen anything like it.
I completely agree with that. Yeah.
In my career, because like, as far as, you know, like FIRE is a great organization because we have people who actually vote for different people working in the same office, you know, and I mean, mainstream candidates, not just, you know, like when I worked at the ACLU, it was Democrats and the Green Party. We actually try to have people who are Republicans and Democrats, working side by side. And the most radioactive topic that used to come into us was always, actually, take a guess. What do you think the most radioactive topic we would hit before transgender became?
I'm blanking.
Israel Palestine.
Okay, you know what? That one was low hanging fruit.
Yeah, well, no. As soon as I say it, I knew it would be clear. Yeah. And that's one of the ones where we're kind of like, oh, this one's going to be fun because everyone's so reasonable. And of course, we've defended, you know, everybody on every possible position on things related to Israel Palestine. It was only around, goodness, like what, 2014, 2015, that you really started seeing transgenderism become the, you know, the new kind of like a third rail. It's interesting because, you know, when it comes to things like, can you make someone use someone's preferred pronouns? There's already been some case law on this, and the answer so far is no, because there's a very strong presumption against compelled speech. However, can you say that, you know, maybe professors should have professional norms that say they should respect what students want? That's probably their strongest argument. When it comes to just regular citizens, can you force them to call someone something that they don't want to call somebody? No, because there's a especially strong presumption against compelled speech. And frankly, there should be. I think that at the moment, the discussion around transgenderism is starting to break open a little bit. Like I see people saying things that I think would have gotten them fired even a year ago and actually trying to have some discussion around it. But I don't think the current level of sort of the number of new taboos that seem to be created just in the last 5 years, I don't think it's sustainable for a democratic society. So there's going to be more litigation, I'm sure, around a lot of these issues.
Well, and debate.
But when,
yeah.
it, but one thing that I really do want to stress is that I think we have an incorrect conception of freedom of speech, even among its supporters. They like the marketplace of ideas metaphor, whereas I prefer the lab and the looking glass, which is my own goofy term for it, I'm trying to get some alliteration in there. But really just saying that it's valuable to know what people think, full stop.
Yeah, but then the question is whether you still want to associate with them. I mean, that would be the argument. Yeah. So a company might say, all right, well, now we know what you think, and we don't want to hang with you anymore. You're fired.
Yep. And I mean, can they do that? Yeah. But like I said, it's a cultural thumb on the scale. Like I said, that it's not sustainable to have a situation where, you know, in order to have a job, you have to keep all of your political opinions to yourself.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things, and I have to admit, one of the things that shocked me, and I'm surprised that I'm able to be shocked by any of this, was the reaction of booksellers and people in the library community.
Yeah.
Who rushed to censor or block books, particularly on this transgender issue that they did not like. And you know, some of these organizations that have whole websites devoted to, you know, Burn Books Week and things like that had no problem. And I guess that's also part of the culture, because no bookstore is required under the law to sell a certain book. So this is a matter of their individual editing choice. But when we talk about the culture, and how targeted it was. So, you know, one of the things listening to you, and this, I go back a long way in watching what's been happening to other free speech organizations like the ACLU, and I get the sense that you may be taking on fights that were once the ACLU's turf. There's been a bit of mission drift with the ACLU. And by the way, I should mention a couple things. When I was a kid growing up, speaking of nerds, when I was a kid growing up, my father was actually the executive director of the Wisconsin Civil Liberties Union. So we grew up, but also he was one of those who drifted away from the organization because the organization drifted away from free speech and, you know, decided it was going to become involved in many, many, many issues. So this is a long-standing concern where the one organization that for years had been the bulwark of free speech decided to go off in a different direction. So talk about this, because I remember, you know, when they defended the Nazis in the 70s marching through Skokie, Illinois, I mean, I thought this was, you know, an indication that you were going to stand for free speech, you know, under the most extreme circumstances. But they've morphed, haven't they?
Yeah.
So talk to me about the ACLU and your relationship to them.
You know, it always puts us in a somewhat difficult situation because, you know, like we don't want to badmouth the ACLU. FIRE has worked with the ACLU, particularly the state affiliate, since we were founded back in 99. We've done lawsuits together with them. You know, I worked at the ACLU back in 1999 when I was still in law school. Nadine Strossen is someone I co-author with, the former president of the ACLU. We co-author stuff all the time. Ira Glasser, who's the former executive director of the ACLU, is on our board of advisors. So we're happy to continue to work with them in the future. And we are sure that we will. We actually want them to send their, you know, free speech cases that they can't take our way. But some of the things that we are trying to do differently than the ACLU is, one, the 19 issue areas that the ACLU have means that there are groups within the ACLU that see each other in tension. I don't necessarily think they are. This was something that was happening back when I was, you know, interning there in 99. There was claims that we can't both support the right of abortion protesters because we are pro-choice. And to people like me and James Weinstein out of Arizona State University School of Law, we're like, no, actually, you really can do both. But it does create this kind of constant tension. So FIRE, as we extend off campus, we're just going to have one cause, and that's freedom of speech. Another thing that we're going to try to do is, when I interned there, I think that the lack of sort of political diversity within the organization was unhealthy. I think that, you know, my Republican and religious executive director helps keep the rest of us honest. You know, I think that kind of diversity, having that kind of internal diversity, really helps. And the biggest difference, you know, as we've talked about, is this idea of free speech culture, that essentially free speech law by itself is, it's not even going to survive forever if there isn't a cultural commitment. But when it comes to some of the stuff that we've seen, you know, and this is related to, and I know people hate the term, but I've accepted it now, cancel culture, you know, after Coddling the American Mind came out, people from corporations, both for-profit and non-profit, started coming to me in height saying, we're dysfunctional now. And the first time I heard about this was a friend of mine who I will not name, who works for a direct services progressive nonprofit. And she wanted to, quote unquote, have a word with me about my book. And I was like, oh, man, she's going to rip me a new one. Like, this is going to be ugly. And she said, actually, it's dysfunctional that essentially a lot of these new hires coming in, they think everything is sort of like an internally focused, the battle is actually against the organization itself, not for the people they're trying to help. And there was an article by Ryan Grimm, which I urge everyone to read, mm-hmm. in The Intercept. Finally, someone saying, yeah, this is really happening, and it is actually pretty destructive. And I think that that's something that gives me some hope, you know, that fever is breaking. I think fire, believe me, like we've seen, I mean, our staff leans more to the left than to the right, despite, mm-hmm. you know, stereotypes. We see this coming up, as well, but we have a good inoculation against it by the fact we have, there isn't as much groupthink. I think that that being a problem, I mean, you know, one of the things they quote in Ryan Grimm's article is Bernie Sanders saying stop hiring activists is a pretty good sign that maybe a cultural trend has gone too far.
So you mentioned that you have this major campaign, and you actually have a number on it, which is pretty big. I mean, $75 million campaign aimed at boosting and solidifying support for free speech values. And I really probably do need to disclose now that you're going to be working with Longwell Partners.
Yep.
Longwell Partners, owned, of course, by Sarah Longwell, who is the one of our colleagues here and the publisher of The Bulwark, although this is separate here. So you actually have this public relations campaign, and I noted this initiative includes television spots.
Yep.
Talk to me about this. One features a student from a conservative student from Emerson College who was suspended for circulating China kind of sucks stickers, right? You know, promoting
China kind of sus,
which is
young person slang for a suspect. And it comes from video games. Apparently.
Oh, okay, kind of sus. Okay, promoting the idea that China was behind the pandemic, so he was suspended for this. So that's one of your spots.
Yeah. I it wasn't about the pandemic. The response was actually to the clampdown in Hong Kong.
Okay. So another spot features a Montana State University student who was ordered to take down a Black Lives Matters banner from his dorm room. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is interesting. But also, Politico wrote about your plans and noted that you are likely to face an uphill battle with people on the left who are really tired of unfettered free speech after all of Trump's misinformation. And speaking of difficult, you know, conversations here, this is part of the problem with so much, I don't know, just toxic bullshit out there. So much, so many lies,
so much.
So people go, okay, you know, is free speech basically a green light for all of this garbage, all of this sewage that has done so much to destroy our democracy? In some ways, has free speech proven to be incompatible with a soundly functioning democracy? I mean, that's a tough question.
Yeah, I don't think it's really that tough. I think that, you know, like this 1521 problem that I'm talking about, you know, is that we're in this anarchical period and there are lots of people right, left and middle who would like to put the genie back in the bottle. And it's literally impossible. Like there's no way after adding billions of people to the international discussion that it's not going to be one of the most disruptive times in history. So I don't think there's any top down way to fix this. It's easy. And when it comes to the misinformation stuff, yes, I think particularly the savvy Russian troll farms, you know, they were very clever in ways that they could, you know, attempt to manipulate public opinion. According to my friend Jakub Bishengama in his book Free Speech, the evidence seems to indicate that it was less successful than most people think in terms of, you know, people believed what they already believe, essentially is a lot of what the findings is there. But when it comes to deciding what is and is not true, that's the whole ball game. Like that's epistemology. Like, and that's never easy. I'm name dropping a ton of friends, but Jonathan Rauch wrote an absolutely must read book called Constitution of Liberty.
Yes,
where he talks about the right and the left. You know, it's one of the reasons why I don't think it was a bestseller. Is it make either side particularly happy? But it makes the point that figuring out, and the funny thing is, it's not so much as figuring out what is true, because you can almost never get there. It's figuring out what's not true. Knowledge, for the most part, is this nonstop process of subtraction. And one of the reasons why the idea that we can sort of easily clamp down on misinformation is something that Mark Zuckerberg got, you know, a lot of hate for when he said this a couple of years ago. But you don't want Facebook to be the final arbiter of truth. And that's actually a very important thing to understand, that the way in which we construct truth is by no means easy. It's arduous. It requires discipline. It requires open discussion. And the idea that you can just fix, you know, misinformation by having, you know, some omniscient institution from above is the way you end up in a really bad authoritarian situation. So, yeah, misinformation is a problem. But one of the cures to it is that more people have authorities that they trust. And right now, people don't trust authorities very much. Some of that's unfair. Some of it's the result of this 1521 problem, the idea that we're going through this major upheaval. But in some cases, some of these experts have done this to themselves to some degree. So there's both rational and irrational reasons for there being an erosion of trust. What is going to happen is that eventually people are going to start saying, you know what, this organization, this person, they're always doing their best to be honest, even if they're not always right. We need a new class of people that even those across, you know, at least reasonable people across the lines of difference can all go, it's like, no, that's actually a trustworthy source. Because right now we're in kind of epistemic anarchy.
Epistemic anarchy. All right. So in the spirit of the difficult questions, you are tomorrow magically made the president of Facebook, now known as Meta, or let's say that you become, you know, Elon Musk calls you up after we're done with this podcast and says, hey, Greg, would you like to be the new CEO of Twitter? And one of the decisions you have to make is you have evidence of Russian troll farms spreading disinformation. Yeah. Is it a violation of the culture of free speech for you to say, no, we're going to block that. We're not going to allow that on either Facebook or Twitter. What do you think?
I don't think so.
What does Greg do?
In that case, you know, like, and I've been asked this by people at Facebook, and my answer is, first, you know, try to borrow wisdom from existing First Amendment jurisprudence, not because you have to, but because it's 100 years of deep thinking about how you have freedom of speech in the real world. My co-author, Jonathan Haidt, we definitely see like the troll farms and the bots as major problems. So does Elon Musk. His idea that he would get rid of the bots and that would help discourse, I think he's almost certainly right. And particularly when it's intentional manipulation, you know, of democratic countries, that makes it all the more justifiable to get rid of them. Now, one of the most controversial recommendations that Haidt had, that I have some reservations about, but I think I think he has a good point, that if you were to not get rid of anonymity, but require someone at some point, you know, in the process of social media to prove that they're a real person, and even if they have a fake name in their account, or they have a name that a post transition name, for example, that if they're real people connected to real reputations, that helps address the problem with bots and with propaganda and with troll farms and all this kind of stuff. I get nervous, of course, when you talk about lack of anonymity, because lack of anonymity is the most justifiable when there is very little possibility of you having your life ruined for what you say. And cancel culture makes it harder to justify that. And certainly Erdogan, Putin, Xi, people who live in other countries, they need anonymity if they want to actually say anything. But I do think that there are sort of ways to address some of these problems that aren't strictly top down. And I think that I think that there is a possibility, and this here's where I'm going to sound like an old fashioned techno utopian. When we have billions of people in the conversation, at this point, Martin Gurry wrote this, a good book called Revolt of the Public. And the way I sort of summarize it is, after social media became a major force in human politics, we suddenly had the tools to be able to tear down any institution, any idea, or any person. And this is a mixed bag because, absolutely, Hosni Mubarak, good riddance. Harvey Weinstein, good riddance. Older ideas. There are a lot of ideas that needed to be torn down. But we haven't figured out yet a way to have these billions of voices help us build really anything yet. But I don't think we have to assume it's always going to be that way. And the idea of suddenly having billions of people in the conversation, having this massive system for organized disconfirmation, I mean, that's what universities are supposed to be. They're supposed to be, like, the scientific method is supposed to be organized disconfirmation. I think that we shouldn't underestimate what potentially can be done that could be positive. It seems very far off in the future now, but I do think that, and this is going to sound very pie in the sky, but we could actually potentially create at least different forms of social media that could actually be a boon to even human knowledge.
All right. Well, let me give you the flip side of that. We also have technology that creates deep fakes. Mm-hmm. That we really don't know how that's going to impact our political and cultural debate. So I understand your point about you don't want Facebook to be the ultimate arbiter of truth, but are lies, demonstrable lies and falsehoods, are they protected free speech?
They are, generally. They're
protected by what?
When it comes to the First Amendment, it's partially because, and this is also one of the ways in which the wisdom that's been imparted, is that people get things wrong all the time, and someone might not actually even think that they're lying when they say something that's untrue. Now, within defamation law, however, as we saw in the Johnny Depp case, we have a very high bar in New York Times versus Sullivan that if you're a public official or a celebrity, you have to prove that someone knowingly lied in a way that actually damaged you. But that's not considered protected speech, even in the extremely free speech protective First Amendment. Now, when it comes to people who are actively trying to mislead you, the hope there, and particularly, and it's one of the best arguments for getting rid of anonymity, is that you get to try that once and nobody will ever trust you again after that.
Yeah.
But right now, for a lot of the things that I think have us both down about the state of American politics, or sometimes alternatively scared to death about the state of American politics, yeah, is that we're still in this anarchical period where people don't know which sources they trust.
Well, you've opened up another front here, and I'm sorry we've gone long here, but because I mean, we talked about academic freedom, we've talked about the First Amendment, we've talked about the culture of free speech, in American corporations and in the private sector. But you raised the whole issue of that there is defamation law, and we are seeing these lawsuits against media outlets on the right, Newsmax, Fox News, from people like Dominion Voting Machines, that are basically saying, you lied about us and we're going to hold you accountable. I'm just guessing that you don't regard those as attacks on free speech. In fact, they strike me as kind of one of the safety valves of free speech, that if in fact you do engage in real misconduct, there are ways of dealing with it short of censorship, but you are held accountable. Okay, you don't silence them, but if you lie and if it is proven that you have with real malice, and knowing disregard of the truth, then you will be held accountable, and that may mean that Newsmax will, as JVL wrote the other day, will end up being owned by Dominion voting machines.
Yeah. Well, this is something that like David French and I talk a fair amount about, and one of the reasons why we get annoyed by when people try to dismiss quote unquote free speech absolutists, because, point me to who you're talking to. And mm-hmm. It's usually someone who doesn't know all that much about First Amendment or freedom of speech, because the exceptions to free speech under the, American understanding are, I have some reservations about a couple of them. But when it comes to things like, racial harassment, to truth threats, to defamation, these exist for very sensible reasons. And that's one of the reasons why I think something that can really erode faith in freedom of speech is when people are threatened, with physical harm or death on Twitter or on social media in a way that actually feels like a credible threat, and nothing is done about it. Because, we don't just think that, intimidation in the sense of, actual true threats should be protected. We actually think that people should be getting in trouble for that. And it's the same thing with defamation. You know, like I don't foresee free speech lasting very long if you had to allow for the idea that everyone's allowed to, call you a pedophile, even if they know it's not true, and ruin your career. I think that some of the limitations that we place on freedom of speech in the American system are very sensible. And I think it's very smart that we use a categorical system instead of a pure balancing system, because it maximizes the amount of protected speech while making it very clear what the unprotected isn't.
Greg Lukianoff is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And his most recent book, which he co-authored, is The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, working on a book on cancel culture. Greg, it is great to have you back on the podcast.
Such a pleasure. And listeners, check out the commercials. I'm a sucker for them. You know, like I could watch this kind of content all day, but it's really a moving reminder of how important free speech is to a democratic society.
And where can I find
them? YouTube.com/thefire.org.
The Fire, spelled exactly the way you would think.
Yep. The Fire Org.
Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio production by Jonathan Siri. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. And we'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.
It's tax season, and by now, we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money in refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it. Guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein-rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand-fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Shiba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Shiba.com.